look what's happening in Africa. What are you saying?
Africa will be a key partner in building the world we want to live in, whether it is on climate, digital, or trade.
Our continent will continue to make steady advances in women's education and equal access to services, thereby laying the foundation for more stable and peaceful societies.
For many African nations, megatrends like globalization and digitalization offer both great opportunity and enormous challenges, in part because of external players vying to assert their own interests. How the resulting upheaval impacts the continent is the subject of a project called Megatrends Africa, and this is the accompanying podcast series. On today's episode, we're discussing drone warfare. Its role in Ukraine regularly makes headlines here in Europe, but drone usage in wars in Africa, particularly in the continent's north, receive far less attention from the press, much like the conflicts themselves. Yet military-grade combat drones are being increasingly deployed in conflicts where capacity for military airstrikes has been limited. Until now, that is. And while the proliferation of their use suggests the technology is key to combat strategy in the region, a new policy brief argues that this is rarely the case. I'm your host, Esme Nicholson, and to present the findings of this brand new publication, we're joined today by two of its authors, Gerrit Kurz and Wolfram Lacher. Based here at SWP, Gerrit Kurz researches conflict prevention, peace building, and diplomacy in the wider Horn of Africa, including Sudan and Ethiopia. Gerrit, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Hello, good to be here.
And Wolfram Lacher co-directs the project Megatrends Africa. His expertise includes security and defense policy, non-state violence, civil wars, and regional and interstate conflicts in North Africa and the Middle East, in particular in Libya and the Sahel. Wolfram, welcome to the studio. Great to have you here.
Hi there. Likewise. Thank you.
So before we address how combat drones impact the power dynamics in conflicts across Northern Africa, perhaps we could start by briefly defining the kind of drones being used. I believe they're called male drones. Why?
Yes, so there are different ways to categorize these drones. But to keep it simple, perhaps I will just keep it to three, and I will come to our focus in the end. So they are, of course, smaller tactical drones, often made from commercial parts. You know, our listeners may be familiar with those that are available commercially, and they use them for filming landscapes, and they can also be used for military purposes. You know, you put a grenade there, and then you drop it, and then it can be used, or it can be used also for surveillance. Then there are also other types of drones that are slightly larger, that are so-called loitering munitions or kamikaze drones that explode on impact, but they can keep in the air for a long time. And finally, and this is our focus, they are the medium altitude long endurance drone, or abbreviated MAL, medium altitude long endurance. And they're called this way because they fly for several thousand meters above ground and can stay in the air for a long time, sometimes up to 20, 24 hours, depending on the model. And they are effectively relatively small, uncrewed planes. They require a runway and they can fly up to 150 kilometers of communication range to the drone pilot. They can be used for surveillance only and targeting, but many others are fitted with missiles, and so for direct combat use. And because of their altitude, that enables them to avoid most anti-aircraft defense weapons available to insurgents. These MALE drones are cheaper and easier to use than conventional warplanes, but they still require significant training and support. And perhaps the most famous model that people know is the Bayraktar TB2 made by Turkey.
Well, and we'll come to that a little bit later on. In your policy brief, and Wolfram, perhaps I can start with you, you point out that there is a belief among African military officers and rebel leaders that MALE drone technology is a game changer, hence its acquisition. But your research findings suggest otherwise, and that this assumption is perhaps too technologically determinist. Why?
Yeah, so we quote a Malian army officer who says that combat drones have allowed our army to make a leap. We also quote the head of the rapid support forces in Sudan, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who said that who attributed an important military defeat, the loss of the city of Wad Madani, to the introduction of Iranian combat drones by his adversary. And so we thought that it's worth taking these statements seriously and to examine these kinds of claims. And of course, drones are not the first innovation in military technology where these kinds of claims are made, and there is a long debate among military experts, which, by the way, full disclosure, none of us three authors are, but we are aware that this debate about innovations in military technology has yielded two key insights that also apply in this case here, in the case of drones in Africa, which is first that the impact that new technology will have also depends on an army's other properties, on their command and control structures, on their intelligence and logistical capabilities, and so on and so forth. And second, that any innovation, any technological innovation, will trigger adaptation by the adversary, which will then dent the impact, the revolutionary impact that new technology will have. So all of this, of course, also applies in this case. But we also think that there are three more specific factors that apply, particularly in African conflicts, and that mediate the impact that combat drones have in these kinds of conflicts, which is first, whether only the government or whether both parties to a conflict have access to combat drones or to the technology needed to counter them, such as sophisticated air defense systems. Second, whether belligerents fight open battles or whether they resort to guerrilla warfare, so whether warfare is regular or irregular. And third, whether the terrain offers ample opportunity for concealment, for example, through forests or through buildings in cities, or whether we're dealing with, completely open, arid terrain, of which there is, of course, quite a lot in Africa's northern half. And we argue that in practice, these three factors actually rarely combine in ways that allow for a maximally effective use of combat drones.
And having read your paper, it seems counterintuitive or surprising at first glance that access to and knowledge of how to operate such drones could be equal in a civil war. Your findings show that this can be the case, though, and that it is the result of increasing foreign intervention, as I understand it, in particular by non-Western powers. Gerrit, tell us more about this, perhaps using Sudan. I know you're an expert for Sudan as an example.
So what we've seen, especially in the past few years, when you look at the use of armed drones in Africa, is that there's been a significant increase in their use and also their acquisition by African militaries. And in the first few years, drone strikes were mainly by non-African militaries, for example, by the United States and Somalia, mainly, and maybe listeners will be familiar with that. But in the last few years, especially around 2019 and following that, we've seen that this has picked up, and also African militaries have used them to a significant degree because they've acquired them from the United Arab Emirates, from Iran, from Turkey, mainly. And Sudan is indeed an example of that. So in Sudan, the Sudanese armed forces, or the regular army, they use different types of drones. They use these male drones. They have Turkish and Iranian drones, but also, as Wolfram already alluded to, their counterparts, but to a lesser degree. So the Sudanese armed forces have used these drones to significant advantage because they've been able to pinpoint targets much more precisely than they've been able with their conventional air force. So that has been an advantage so far. But now in the past few months, the RSF has apparently also acquired not just smaller drones, which they have had and used for quite a long time, but also these male drones, Chinese-made male drones. And they have started also to deploy them, for example, to bomb a hospital in Al-Fasher, the capital of North Darfur. but so far, they have just a few of these. So we are yet to see whether they can use them to full advantage and integrate them also in their military approach. If they are able to do that, then that would be a significant, not necessarily advantage, but with significant perhaps change also how they can operate vis-a-vis the Sudanese armed forces.
And Wolfram, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the dynamics in Libya.
Libya in 2019 became the first African country and probably also one of the very first countries worldwide where both sides in a civil war were using combat drones provided by foreign supporters. And that happened because one side, Khalifa Haftar's forces, was supported by the United Arab Emirates, while their adversaries, the forces of the Tripoli government, were backed by Turkey. And since then, since 2019, we've seen these two states, as well as Russia, intervene in a number of African conflicts. And in most cases, this has been taking the form of support to governments against rebel forces who have not gained comparable support. But in two cases, in Libya and in Sudan, these non-Western powers have backed both sides or have been, you know, have been backing both sides in a conflict. And this has also involved the use of combat drones as well as the use of air, sophisticated air defense equipment. And in these two cases, we've seen that Western states have largely stood by and have largely remained silent as supposed allies such as the UAE, Egypt, Turkey have fueled these conflicts, and which is why I think that we could see such patterns in more African conflicts in the future.
Well, and Gerrit, the war in Ethiopia is often cited as a clear example of where foreign-supplied drones have changed the course of the conflict. But you argue that the picture is actually more complex than that. Why?
Yeah, because also the terrain in Ethiopia is more complex, and I think it shows quite well how these three factors that we identified work. So Ethiopia received foreign drones from the UAE, from Iran, from Turkey. In the fall of 2021, when it was still in heavy conflict between the government and the Tigray Defense Forces, the government was really on the defense, and the Tigray Defense Forces, the rebels, were on the offensive towards the capital. Yeah, outside of Tigray, coming south towards the capital, Addis Abeba. And when they did so, these newly acquired drones, they really tipped the balance, as the New York Times put it at the time, because these rebel fighters, they were on a major road. It was a large column of fighters, which was then relatively flatter around this major road. So they could be easily identified from the air, and they had nothing to defend themselves against the Bayraktar TB2 and these other drones. So they could be easily picked apart. And so the TDF, the Tigray Defense Forces, had to withdraw before they could reach the capital. But once they were back in Tigray and the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, you know, were coming back behind them, the army stopped because Tigray is very mountainous. And the army had made the experience already before in the war that the rebels, you know, would withdraw to the mountains, to caves, to rifts, and that they had already lost once in guerrilla warfare just before. So they didn't want to replicate that necessarily. They still use drones there, also in urban environments. But there, they mainly caused heavy civilian casualties. And the drones themselves didn't make that major difference anymore once they were in this different terrain. So I think that shows quite usefully, you know, where it makes sense to use these male drones and where it doesn't.
So these are examples of where the factors do align. But as I understand it, they really rarely align to create the conditions where drone warfare has an impact on the power balance. And if this is the case, why is there such a proliferation of combat drones on the African continent? And what does it tell us about regional and international order? Wolfram.
Yes, well, I think that actually the political uses of drones are at least as interesting as the military ones. And the example of Chad, in 2023, the government of Chad acquired Turkish combat drones. And then the following year, it ordered the French military, which had been present in the country for decades, had protected the regime of Idriss Deby, to vacate the country. And of course, there were other factors behind this decision than the drones. But clearly, having those new drones made it possible for the government to dispense with French military support, because they were able to replace the deterrent that as which the French fighter jets had previously functioned with their own new drones. And in fact, only this weekend, Le Monde quoted a senior Chadian military officer as saying, these drones allow us to carry out airstrikes and have our own surveillance and intelligence capabilities without relying on others. And so this shows that the acquisition of drones by governments, particularly in the Sahel region, has fitted in very well with the rise of this sovereignist discourse, the anti-French discourse in that region, particularly. So the drones also function as a propaganda tool for governments in the region. They've helped promote the idea that military leaders in these countries are modernizing their armies and will be able to overcome the security crisis in these countries without depending on Western support. Now, of course, Mali, Burkina Faso, Niger are very far from that actually happening, but clearly the drones are also politically very useful for putschists in these countries.
Gerrit, is this the kind of logic and dynamic that you're seeing also in the regions that you cover?
Well, yeah, the situation is slightly different because you didn't have this deep French influence to begin with in the Horn of Africa. It's a different situation in Sudan and Ethiopia. They still make a difference in the conflicts, but perhaps that aspect is less the case. But I can certainly say is that these drones are not just of political importance for those military governments, or other governments, authoritarian governments as well, but also for those governments supplying them, right? So they are also an instrument of influence, yeah, for the United Arab Emirates, for Turkey, for Iran. Yeah, the Turkish president Erdogan has toured African countries and has then said, you know, everywhere I go, they want is UAVs from them. Yeah, the Bayraktar TB2. They are very popular because of their assumed properties that we've talked about, perhaps. So there's almost a myth to some extent surrounding them. Of course, there is something to it, and we've discussed this. But to some extent, it's also perhaps a status symbol, yeah, for some governments and for some militaries. And it also helps them, and you know, it also helps those countries supplying them. So it also helps increase the role of Turkey in Africa, and also helps increase the influence of the United Arab Emirates, where they are supplying these kind of weapons, for example, and in Sudan, but also in Ethiopia, the UAE have very strong influence on some of these actors.
So we're seeing a shift in influence from Western powers to non-Western powers. Is this a development that we're going to continue to see?
I think because the United States has been by far the most important actor in African conflicts previously, this is changing. Yeah? And of course, the US's role is also changing globally, as we are very painfully aware in Europe, of course. And with this changing order, yeah, with this decline of the US hegemony, yeah, and US willingness, especially US readiness, to be a security provider, perhaps, and to some extent France, perhaps, and other countries as well, but US in particular, perhaps, other countries, you know, are seeing their chances and are seizing them, very much so.
Well, we're nearly out of time for today, so I'd like to thank our guests Gerrit Kurz and Wolfram Lacher. You'll find links to their latest work, including the publication we discussed today, in the podcast show notes, where you'll also find a link to the project Megatrends Africa. And if you like what you hear, you can subscribe to us in the usual places, including on Spotify and Apple. You can also keep up to date with the latest analyses from SWP on Blue Sky and on LinkedIn. Today's episode was brought to you by our editor, Maya Dana, by me, your host, and of course, by our guests. So until next time, it's goodbye from all of us.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for tuning in.